So tonight we're going to be talking about breakup songs, and it's entitled From Roar to Let It Go, Reflections on the Triumphant Modern Breakup Song. And most of you probably know, who've listened to any pop music at all, there's been breakup songs for a long time, and there are lots of them. Because romantic love is such a powerful and potentially good thing, when relationships end, there's carnage emotionally and pain. And so pop music has been there as a way to express it, to cope with it, to seek relief from it, or to wallow in it, depending on how we choose to use pop music. There's a wonderful quote from the film High Fidelity, and maybe from the book as well, I forget, but somewhere near the beginning of that film, John Cusack's character is reflecting on the danger of letting kids listen to pop music. We talk about how, you know, dangerous it is for kids to play violent video games and everything, but we never question the fact that kids are listening to thousands and thousands of hours of songs about misery and heartbreak. And he asked the question, did I listen to music because I was miserable, or was I miserable because I listened to the music? And so pop music majors on songs about romantic love. There's no doubt about that. It's hard to calculate a percentage. It would be an impossible thing to do, I think. But the vast majority of pop songs have something to do with romantic love. Maybe just sex, some of them, but of one stripe or another. Whether it's euphoric kind of being in love songs, or loving someone from afar songs, or tortured, unrequited love songs, or bitter, sad songs about love that's been lost. So in researching for this lecture, I listened to a lot of breakup songs, old and new, and they vary quite a lot, I've noticed, in their emotional content. Some of them express deep sadness, obviously. That's kind of the most obvious first emotion. My world has ended, and I'm trying to cope. Some of them express regret. I miss you, and I've been a fool. Usually these songs are men singing. I'm not over you. I made a big mistake. These are you could call them baby come back songs. In a lot of these breakup songs, there's rage and contempt. That's very, very common these days, I think. There's a song by Eminem. This is more on the sort of the hip-hop R&B side of things, but there's a song by Eminem called Puke. And the video for this, before the video actually starts, is the sound of someone vomiting violently. And this is what he does every time he thinks about this girl. So, rage and contempt. There's kind of a pop country song by Carrie Underwood, which a lot of people are talking about, called Before He Cheats, and it's all about her taking a baseball bat to her ex's pickup truck and destroying the whole thing. Next time, he'll think twice before he cheats. There's breakup songs with a tone of dismissive disdain. There's a classic one by Beyoncé called Irreplaceable, which is basically, the basic message is, I'm going to get another one of you in about 15 minutes. You're totally replaceable. And another one by a singer named Jesse James, a female singer named Jesse James, I look so much better without you. And so you get a little bit of a glimpse of the pettiness of a lot of these songs. And then there's songs that express confidence and recovery, basically. The I'm Over You song, Don't Picture Me Pining Away. And this sentiment has been around for a long time. One of the songs I was playing before the lecture started was I Will Survive, the Gloria Gaynor song, which is a classic kind of, I guess, disco sort of 1970s song with very much that kind of tone to it. I Will Survive. These songs communicate how much better off the person is now. I'm not pathetic, I'm doing fine. Maybe even it communicates your love was not good enough for me to be much affected by the loss of it. You weren't that good. There's a country song from, I think, early 90s or mid 90s maybe, by Patti Loveless. It's always stuck in my head because I used to be really into country music. And the verse says, actually it's the chorus, "You can feel bad if it makes you feel better. Picture me crying, reading all your love letters, walking around in your old sweaters, babe. You can feel bad if it makes you feel better." And so it's all about, I'm completely over you. I'm not affected at all by the end of our relationship. But if your conscience is bothering you, and if it helps you to picture me being really sad, then go ahead. It's very sarcastic and biting. Anyway, and then finally, there's songs that are that communicate triumph in one way or another, and that's the kind of song I'm talking about tonight, an almost victorious kind of attitude where the singer is high on life. These are not sad songs. They don't sound like sad songs. Neither can you easily lump them together with "I'm over you" songs like "I Will Survive." There's something much more going on. They are breakup songs, but ironically, they're also motivational songs. You could call them self-esteem boosting songs. They're songs that are meant to get you pumped up, and they're actually very popular for exercise mixes and things like that. And people have on their iPods to get them going. Very often, maybe just as a result of the groove and the general feel of the song more than the words. So this has struck me as sort of a peculiar thing, because the end of a relationship is, as any of us who've experienced broken relationships, it's a loss. Something that was alive is now dead. Even if the relationship was unhealthy and bad, and it's a good thing to be free from it, still, usually there's some sadness. Sadness is an appropriate response to a broken relationship. But not necessarily in this case. So this is kind of what I want to talk about tonight. And just one quick note before I continue. I've been very, very selective with my choice of songs over the course of the last month or so. I've been talking to people about this topic, and I've gotten dozens and dozens of suggestions. Listen to this one, listen to that one. And I really am not trying to represent all breakup songs here tonight. I'm not really trying to say this is a new trend in pop music. You know, keep your ears out and you'll notice it's all going this way or something like that. Not at all. I basically just picked very selectively the ones that express this kind of thing that I'm interested in talking about, this theme of triumph. And most of these are very well-known songs. I didn't go out of my way to find obscure, like, cool indie rock breakup songs. These are totally mainstream pop songs made for mass consumption, mass appeal. Anyway, so let's listen to a song from 2010. It's a Taylor Swift song. She is really good at writing breakup songs. And one of the ones in the beginning I played before you guys came in here was "We Are Never Ever Ever Getting Back Together." It's a very clever song. I recommend the video is very clever also. But now I'm gonna play one, a different one called "Mean." Let's see. And then we'll move on to my outline. "With your words like knives and swords and weapons that you use against me, you knock me off my feet again. I'm gonna feel like nothing, you. With your words like nails on a chalkboard, calling me out when I wounded you. Picking on the weaker man. You can take me down with just one single blow. But you don't know, what you don't know. So mean. You, with your switching sides and your wildfire lies and your humiliation, you are pointing out my flaws again as if I don't already see them. Never impress you. I just wanna feel okay.
you gotta be so mean?
Keeping track of who's mouthing all the words tonight, just so you know. They're irresistibly catchy, most of these songs, so you're forgiven. when I first heard this song, I wasn't even sure it was a breakup song. I thought it might have been about a parent. It's just vague enough, so it could apply to a lot of situations. Actually, the video of the song interprets the sort of meanness coming from different directions. But it's certainly understood by most people as a breakup song. So it describes a relationship that Taylor Swift probably should have ended. But the song goes much further than to say we're done. It predicts that her life is on a glorious upward trajectory. She's going to be living in a big old city, which is clearly a sign of having arrived in life. I'm a winner. I'm headed somewhere. That's the basic tone, but that's actually not the emphasis of the song. The emphasis is really on how much of a loser the ex is. And so it's a prediction of her ex's whole future. She declares that all he's ever going to be is mean. His life is on a downward trajectory, and he's going to wind up alone in a bar yelling at the TV. There's no hope for him. You're a loser. You're never going to change. You're nothing more than an experience I will have survived. And I'll just look back on you. And so really the song is sort of getting at the type of thing I'm talking about. It's not a perfect example, but it's getting there. The sort of tone of triumph from the song is essentially a result of the contrast between her and this guy whose life is headed downward. So I want to ask maybe a relevant question here. I'm just going to go back a little bit. Are pop songs even worth talking about first? I'm just going to speak about that just for a second or two. Because I guess if most of you who've actually shown up probably think that it may be worth listening to a talk on pop songs, but it's not necessarily what everybody thinks. There used to be a time when, you know, people at Labrie talked about fine art and high culture and these kinds of things. One might say pop music is lacking in depth and quality. There's not enough complexity of content to warrant close attention, basically. So pop music is for mass consumption, it's not high art. Or one might say something like this: lighten up, it's just fun music. Why are you bothering to over-intellectualize something that's basically designed to get people on the dance floor or to pedal harder on the exercise bike? So it was never intended to stand up to analysis. If you spend a lot of time trying to find the point of the music, you're missing the point of the music. And I think a lot of people just listen to this kind of music for the fun of it and don't ever actually notice what the words are saying. And I think that's the truth. The reason I want to talk about mainstream pop music anyway is that if we completely write it off, it's very easy to underestimate its power, actually. Pop music both, I think, indicates something about where our culture is because it's produced by our culture. This is it's an indication of what's actually going on in the minds of people out there. But it also, in addition to indicating something, it also instructs people. It instructs us, those of us in our culture, about how to live. It communicates something to us about what is considered good or desirable, or a lot about what's considered normal. So it tells us something about our culture, but it also teaches us something about how to be a part of our culture. And people who say, you've got to be kidding me, it's just entertainment, pop music isn't in the business of teaching us anything, it's not going to affect how I live, I know these songs don't describe the real world, they're just fun. I think this perspective is at times naive, in a similar way to somebody saying, advertising doesn't affect me, right? Lots of people say that, but I think that's a naive attitude. So it's true that pop music doesn't set up to convince us of anything in the same way that an opinion column would in a newspaper or a political ad or something like that. There are not arguments being made that demand our conscious consideration. For instance, I don't turn off the radio after listening to pop music and say, aha, I now see that it's better to be selfish in life. We don't receive it in that way. We don't receive it in the same way we would if we read an essay on selfishness. But pop music has an impact that's just as powerful, or even more powerful, I think, because it bypasses rational arguments and affects us at the level of our imagination, which is something that Joshua has talked a lot about in reference to pornography, actually, something that even if we know it's wrong and intellectually we can criticize it in every way, it's getting at something very different in us, our imagination, our heart, our desires. And so... without bothering to appeal to our rational minds, they're giving us sort of a gut level or heart level picture of what the good life is or could be. Someone who's written a lot on this subject is James K.A. Smith, in a book called Desiring the Kingdom. And he basically talks about how we're creatures who are every bit as impacted by the desires of our hearts as we are by the thoughts of our minds. So we are desiring creatures, we're not just thinking creatures. And I think pop music has the power to make some things look really beautiful and appealing and other things look stupid and drab and boring. Any art actually has the power to do that to us. So try really hard and try to think of all the pop songs that make working hard, being diligent, self-controlled, faithful, and responsible look really sexy. There is no such thing. That's why even if you totally disagree with the message of a song, quote unquote, it's easy to feel yourself getting caught up in the power of it. These songs are very carefully arranged and well written, some of them, to give the listener this almost sort of transcendent lift, regardless of the content. I have a friend who's a colleague in LaBrie, at a different branch, who he's describing listening to one of the songs we'll hear later on tonight, called Roar. It's a song by Katy Perry. And he's a very smart guy. He listens to a lot of pop music, but he observed that every time he listens to that song, he gets this surge in him, this feeling that he should be really selfish. I'm not sure exactly what that feels like, but he says this is an experience he has. I'm not somebody who would defend selfishness in a conscious way at all. So even if you don't buy into everything I've just said, it's still worth knowing what the vast majority of people in this country are listening to. Pop music is a good indication, I think, of where our culture is at, like I said before, and something that's important to understand or try to understand. So... all that is to say, I'm a big proponent of listening to and even enjoying pop music, but doing so critically, doing so with ears and minds that don't necessarily just swallow whole what we're hearing, rather than just mindless acceptance on the one hand, or, which is often more the case in Christian circles, alarmist legalism. Don't listen to it. Get away. I think both of those are usually fairly unhelpful, except there's some things I think that we should just steer clear of completely, but listening carefully, listening critically is something that I think we need to train ourselves in. So, I think in a lot of the kind of music we're listening to, there's two idols at work here, which actually are in opposition to each other. And when we talk about idols... it's really a biblical term. Idolatry is making a god out of something that is less than the real God and expecting it to give us a sense of meaning and purpose and value that only God can give. So it's an act of worship to something that was never designed to be worshipped. Rather than worshiping the God who's actually made us and gives us meaning, we are basically elevating something from within God's creation, or something that we have constructed ourselves, to the level of supreme importance. The idol is something that actually is not of supreme importance, but it's been wrongly given supreme importance by us. And it becomes something without which life is not worth living, or so we think. I think in a lot of pop music, we see the idolatry of romantic love. There's an assumption that romantic love will solve all our problems. To be in and to stay in the right relationship is the end and goal of our existence. So it's the ultimate object of longing if you don't have it, romantic love. It's the ultimate source of fulfillment if you do have it, supposedly. And it's the ultimate loss and source of grief if you lose it. And so it achieves ultimate status in all these categories, whether you're longing for it, whether you have it, whether you've lost it. One of the first things I think to note is that making an idol out of romantic love might have nothing to do with actually loving another person. It can have more to do with a feeling one has of being in love or being loved. There's a song that I've known for a long time, only recently realized it was Bonnie Raitt who wrote it, but Randy Newman has sung it before. And it goes like this: something in your eyes makes me want to lose myself, makes me want to lose myself in your arms. There's something in your voice makes my heart beat fast. I hope this feeling lasts the rest of my life. A very desperate hope, I would say. Another possible object of love is the image of oneself that one gets from being with the other person. Wow, I'm the type of person who is in this relationship, or who gets this girl, or whatever. Someone wants me, so I must be important or valuable. I must be sexy or irresistibly interesting in some way. All the feelings we get about ourselves that we project onto ourselves, they really have nothing to do with the other person necessarily at all. And so this is also a lack of love for the other person. And it continues, I think, into the post-relationship songs, into the breakup songs. So that the thing being mourned in a breakup song isn't necessarily the loss of the other person, but all the things that that other person produced for us, all the feelings, all the images of ourself that now we have to put to death because we're no longer with that person. Again, Patti Loveless, the country person from the 1990s, she somehow keeps coming back in this talk. I miss who I was with you. It's not I miss you. It's not you, you know, you were a great person. I'm sorry that we broke up. I have regrets. It's not, I miss who I was when I was with you. Could be anybody she's talking about, but it's really an image of herself that's lost, not the other person or the relationship itself. So the idolatry is clear, I think, in both the euphoric in love songs and in the despairing lost love songs. Whether it's your love is the world to me or my world is destroyed, it's still idolatry. It's still something that's been given ultimate status and power in our lives. And this goes way, way, way back. One of the best expressions I could find of this, or best examples, is an old country song by someone named Skeeter Davis. It's gotta be from the 50s, maybe, something like that. And it's called Don't They Know It's the End of the World. I'm just gonna play a section of the song, which is priceless. I think. Anyway,
I remember that.
There you have it. Just a great example of when romantic love reaches this ultimate status, it's as if the world should end. Why does the tide keep coming in? It should stop because this relationship, which meant everything to me, is over. Anyway. And a lot of the pop music I want to play tonight, though, that we'll be listening to, the obsession with romantic love has sort of been usurped by a much more overt obsession with the self. So it's not like this sort of disguised obsession with romantic love that's really just self-love. It's very, very overt. It's all about the self. The loss of the other person is not what's being mourned. Neither is the loss of the feelings they produced. They're actually not songs about loss at all. Rather, they're focused on self-discovery, self-expression, and a newfound personal strength. And these are the things being celebrated and presented clearly as the goal of life. Romantic love might be great, but the self and the personal journey of the self is the new God. And so we're going to listen to a song by Kelly Clarkson from 2011. She was I believe, the first champion from American Idol. She's well known for that, but has made a number of idols since that time. Idols.
Number one.
Albums, sorry. American Idol, got me confused. So this is called Stronger. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And a classic exercise song. So, message, I guess, of this song is not just that I'm over you, or that I'm surviving, or that I'm better off now, or even that I'm stronger as a result of this breakup. It does say that many times. But somehow that as a result of the breakup, I've become awesome. Or have been able to unlock my latent awesomeness. I've become a powerhouse. And so it goes quite a bit further than I will survive. Kelly Clarkson isn't surviving. She's taking over the world. And this newly discovered power is specifically a product of being on her own. Me, myself, and I. In other words, her ex-boyfriend was only a hindrance to her self-discovery. Only on her own can her hidden potential be unleashed in some way. So she sings, the bed is warmer, sleeping here alone, just me, myself, and I. Or the line in the bridge, which is powerful line. It says, thanks to you, I'm finally thinking about me. You know, in the end, the day you left was just my beginning. And so, incidentally, Mary Frances brought to my attention that Britney Spears has a song of the same title, essentially the same song, which communicates basically the same thing. Rather than listening to it, I just excerpted a couple of verses from it. Because now I'm stronger than yesterday. Now it's nothing but my way. My loneliness ain't killing me no more. Which actually is a reference to an early Britney Spears song, which is My loneliness is killing me. So she's saying it's not the case anymore, I guess. I'm stronger than I ever thought that I could be, baby. I used to go with the flow, didn't really care about me. You might think that I can't take it, but you're wrong. Here I go, on my own. Don't need nobody, better off alone. Here I go, on my own. Don't need nobody, not anybody. Here I go. All right, here I go. So this idea that true strength is to be found in isolation. So there's a term coined by psychologists, which has become a very, very popular term just in pop culture and pop psychology, and that is self-actualization. And I haven't done a lot of research on this, so I'm very quickly over my head, but I'll just give you a very cursory kind of definition of self-actualization, which basically has to do with the achievement of one's highest potential. In the 1940s, the psychologist Abraham Maslow developed a model for understanding what motivates human beings in life. He was critical of Freud for focusing on people with pathologies, and he said that gave a skewed picture of human psychology. Instead, Maslow focused on the best and the brightest and the most high-achieving individuals. He was interested in people like Einstein. What is it that made them driven to achieve what they did? And so he called his model for understanding this a hierarchy of needs. At the very top of this hierarchy, it's sometimes been portrayed as a pyramid. There it is. I'm not really going to talk about all the stuff on it, but just for your reference. At the very top of the hierarchy is the need for self-actualization, which according to Maslow, individuals can only achieve if they first succeeded in taking care of all the more basic needs lower down on the pyramid. Maslow says, what a man can be, he must be. This need we may call self-actualization. It refers to the desire for self-fulfillment, namely to the tendency for him to become actualized in what he is potentially. This tendency might be phrased as the desire to become more and more what one is, to become everything that one is capable of becoming. So it's this kind of hunger for our potential to become reality. And Maslow did not think that many people actually reached this final stage. But he did think that it was a powerful driving force that motivates all people to become self-actualized, whether or not they actually achieve it. This model, evidently, has been heavily critiqued in psychological circles. But I think we could certainly critique it from on various points from a biblical perspective, I think. It doesn't say much about ethical, moral decisions on our way to self-actualization, and it doesn't say much about how other people are supposed to function in that endeavor. Regardless of all that, the notion of self-actualization is still powerful in the minds of people on a popular level today. It's a huge thing. It's perceived as something that is available to everybody if you want it badly enough. It's perceived as almost a mandate in our culture that we should be pushing towards achieving our maximum potential, whatever that is. It's an assumption that any healthy person should have this as their highest goal. But the problem is, who knows what their potential is? How do we know that? How can anyone really know what they are capable of potentially? By definition, potential is something we have not yet achieved. We can't actually really know what our potential is, so we can't really know if we've reached it yet. Maybe our potential is even greater. Who knows? See, it's a very triumphalistic kind of model, isn't it? That progress is inevitable somehow. So I think modern people view life as a self-defined journey of self-discovery, because nobody really knows what their potential is. Life is about discovering who you are, who you want to be, and then trying to achieve that. The actualized self is a very sacred and supreme thing, but nobody really knows what it is. But we do seem to know when people are standing in the way. And I think that's one of the weaknesses of self-actualization, if it's our goal in life, if that's our primary goal. It's not at all clear what role other people are to play in that. Relationships with other people might be very important to us, or they might not. But how do relationships actually function when our view of life is primarily as a journey of self-discovery towards actualization? Other people can either be aids to us in reaching our potential, maximizing our potential, or obstacles that will hinder us from realizing our potential. You could say other people take on a role of either being stepping stones towards something great or stumbling blocks, things that get in our way of that goal. And I think this is kind of what we see. It's not being obviously articulated in words, but it's kind of what we see in a lot of these songs we're listening to. The relationship and the other person is viewed as valuable only insofar as it propelled us forward towards our goal of personal greatness. Or they can be viewed with total contempt because they've been a hindrance to us in that. Something that's expendable to be cast aside as we progress to bigger and better things. A few observations here. Relationships that function as a step towards self-actualization will tend to break up quickly. No one wants to be treated as a means to an end. Nobody wants to be treated as a building block in someone else's identity construction. And so if this is how we approach relationships in our culture, there's bound to be a lot of breakup songs. We already live in a culture of impermanence when it comes to relationships. Marriage vows have been rewritten to, you know, till love, you know, until love, for as long as love lasts and things like this. Our culture has been spoken of as a divorce culture, something that's become totally normalized. So permanent relationships are less of an expectation than they have been in the past. Another observation, if God is our God, then something as painful and difficult as a failed relationship can be an opportunity for self-examination, or even growth in humility, maybe even repentance. If God is our God, then questions of our own moral failure can be on the table, actually have to be on the table. So if God is really our God, we can confess to being very, very wrong. But we can do so with the very real hope of forgiveness. If God is our God, then we can also cry out to him in the rawness of our pain when we've been mistreated. So it's not always just our fault, obviously. When we've been treated unjustly, God can be cried out to. But if self-actualization is our God, I can't even say it anymore, if that sort of self-discovery is our God, then an awareness and honesty about our own failure is not really one of the ingredients. It's all about self-esteem. It's all about progressing sort of positively. And so This means that we really can't be wrong, and the breakup must signify some kind of victory, some further proof of how great we are. It must signify forward progress in one way or another. So we really have no choice but to be stronger as a result. This is if God is not our God. So it's something that you hear over and over again. It's a total cliche, but just when people talk about, I have no regrets, you know, what happened happened, no regrets, you know, which basically assumes this kind of everything that happens in my life serves to make me a better person, closer to my potential. So there's certainly no room for remorse, but it seems to me there's not even much room for grief in a lot of these songs. Honest mourning for what's been lost. Triumph is the only option, it seems. And I think just we have to be honest that this is a completely unrealistic picture of life, of real life. Even relationships that are destructive and should end are the source of a lot of pain when they do end. Let alone relationships that were positive in some way. So I think most of us know on some level this is a lie, that somehow when relationships destruct, we get up off the ground and start dancing. The song by Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, I think is a very, very dark, despairing song. Not a PG song either, so I didn't play it tonight. But probably more honest perspective on the pain of a breakup than any of the other songs we're listening to, in terms of how it actually feels to real people. And now a caveat to the whole discussion. To what extent are these kind of triumphantly toned songs a corrective to something? You've probably noticed that every single one of these songs are sung by women. And each one seems to be referring to past relationships that really were unhealthy and demeaning to them as women. And I don't think we can dismiss this or brush it aside as a legitimate motivation for some of the attitudes in the songs. Because despite all the obsession with the self, which we've been talking about, most of these songs are at least in part a reaction to something that actually is very bad. There are many, many messages floating around in our culture that tell particularly young girls that all you need is a man. Not just young girls. This message resonates in the ears of people of any age. If you have a man, you are somebody. If you don't, you are nobody. Your identity is to be found in a man. Your role is like that of a satellite to your man. And the implication to all this is that it's worth it to put up with all kinds of demeaning treatment in order to keep your man, in order to maintain the relationship, so to speak. Even abuse is worth it if standing up for yourself means losing your man. And that's all over the place, sometimes very subtly. And I think it's a completely evil message and doesn't have a place in our hearts as Christians. I don't want my daughters thinking of themselves in that way. I don't want my son growing up thinking he can view women in that way. So a lot of other pop music, the complicated thing is a lot of other pop music seems to reinforce these kinds of dysfunctional messages, basically. Songs that basically say to men, I'm nothing without you, do whatever you want to me. Thinking of songs by Miley Cyrus, Britney Spears, even in, played out in the personal life of the singer Rihanna, who's beaten to a pulp by her boyfriend and takes him back again. It's just all in the tabloids. Somehow the relationship is worth maintaining, even if it's destroying her. The Britney Spears song, I'm a Slave for You, it says, I really want to dance tonight with you. I just can't help myself. I really want to do what you want me to. I just got to let myself go. That's just one very PG version of this. But the basic message is that she's sexually available with no stipulations, no expectations or standards for being treated well. Whatever you want me to do, that's what I want to do. And that's just on some level it's just salesmanship. I think everybody knows that sex can sell almost anything. And so, pop music is an example of that, certainly. But there's something very, very deep and more destructive going on, having to do with the power of men over women and women's own complicity in it, acceptance of that as normal. So we see, I think this is just one example or one manifestation of what we see in Genesis 3:16. I believe it was the scholar Mary Stuart Van Leeuwen who observed this, and many other people too, maybe, when as part of the curse, so this isn't God saying, and here's how I want it to be, this is as a result of the curse, things haven't gone wrong, your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you. So Van Leeuwen points to this as maybe a sort of a prediction of the particular type of idolatry that maybe men and women will be susceptible to. Men will idolize their own power and abuse it, and women, out of their desire for the relationship, are likely to forfeit their God-given dominion and creational dignity that they're supposed to not forfeit. Your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you. So this is talking about marriage specifically, but also I think is a description of something much more broad in the relationship between men and women. So maybe triumphant breakup songs are offering an alternative perspective to all this, and all of the narrators are saying no to being pushed around, take it for granted, and treated like a satellite or a possession. And you could say they're providing a corrective or a critique, maybe. That's an aspect of what's going on. They're basically saying, come on, girls, stand up for yourselves. Don't let some guy dominate you or define who you are. You're worth more than that. Be empowered. This is probably why they make such good exercise songs. Because they're about empowerment lyrically, and musically they get you pumped up, right? So the music and the lyrics are very much complementary. And so this is just trying to add a nuance to it rather than just kind of critiquing across the board everything that we're listening to tonight. On some level, there's a response to something that needs to be responded to. Whether we agree with the particular solution or not is another issue. So anyway, the next song we'll listen to, I think, exemplifies this. It's called Roar. It's by Katy Perry from 2013. I think it's worth noting that there's a very intentional reference to the song I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar, which is from the 1970s. It's a pop song by Helen Reddy, which in the 1970s became sort of a feminist anthem of sorts. It's all about female empowerment and the hard-won wisdom of women, and it even claims invincibility. I am invincible, it says. Anyway. But anyway, I think Katy Perry is sort of referencing this, perhaps to get some mileage out of the gravitas or authority of this older song. But Katy Perry's song is less about female solidarity and the rights of women. It's more about just showing her ex how tough she is. And so I'm not sure that it gains much gravitas from that reference. Anyway.
Breaking
So, musically, this song is very powerful, I think. It's, we were all kind of getting into it. It has an irresistible kind of groove to it. Even if we roll our eyes at what the song is saying, it's very easy to get caught up in the sheer energy of it. This song has been played from time to time in our car as we drive, and it's become something that everybody's yelling by the end of the song. In this sense, it's a well-written pop song, right? It affects you on a level of the gut or the imagination. We become almost, not necessarily enamored consciously, but in a subconscious way, singing along with something that we could not articulately defend in any way, right? And that's one of the benefits of listening to it and talking about it and forcing ourselves to articulately say what it's saying. Like, because if not, it has a different sort of power over us, I think. But lyrically, it's obviously very combative. The wealth of boxing references in it it's all over the place. Eye of the Tiger, it's a song by the band Survivor, which was the theme song from all the Rocky movies. So all the Rocky movies where Sylvester Stallone is training, it's the Eye of the Tiger. And so there's that going for it. She's a fighter. You knocked me down, but I got up. It's just this image of being in the boxing ring. And then there's this great line about floating like a butterfly and stinging like a bee, which is what Muhammad Ali was quoted as saying when he was, that was kind of his way of intimidating his opponents. This relationship, or the end of it, is likened to a fist fight, and she's going to win. So the relationship has served to boost her in her belief in herself and her own strength, her own resourcefulness. It caused her to go from zero to her own hero. She went from having no choice and falling for everything to being able to roar. And so that's the transition there, of utter powerlessness to almost absolute power. Roaring, presumably in the face of her ex-boyfriend. I don't know what that means exactly. There's lots of mixed metaphors. And, the relationship, again, this is sort of recurring pattern. The relationship is the drab background for her new self-discovery. It's nothing more than a stepping stone in the journey of becoming who she wants to be. So its purpose was to, again, propel her towards her own higher excellence. So, you get the idea. I want to broaden the discussion a little bit now, beyond just romantic relationships, to include the whole concept of relationship. I think these are not just anti-ex-boyfriend songs. There's something subtly being communicated about all connection with other people. The individuals portrayed are so huge that there isn't room for anybody else. If this is the attitude that you go around with life, you know, are you ever going to be in another relationship? Who knows? Anyway, one could debate that point, but I want to transition now to the song "Let It Go," which is, I think, sort of an extreme articulation of some of these ideas. It's not a breakup song, at least not with a boy. But I've the more I've listened to it, the more I've realized it's a breakup song with the rest of humanity. All society is sort of a cathartic escape from the restrictions of community in general. Because humanity is the source of so many of the restrictions we experience in life, society is abandoned with much the same purpose of self-actualization, self-discovery, and in this case, completely unconfined self-expression. Unfettered self-expression. So, Let It Go. It's from the movie Frozen, a Disney movie just from this past year. It's a very, very loose retelling of Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tale, The Snow Queen, which I read recently and realized there's almost no connection. It looms large in our culture right now. Its popularity is almost hard to believe. The movie Frozen won the Academy Award for Best Animated Movie. Let It Go, which was written by a husband and wife duo, Robert Lopez and Kristen Anderson Lopez, and was performed by the singer Idina Menzel, won Best Song in the Academy Awards. The movie Frozen has topped the $1 billion mark in the box office. That was back in April, so it was a while ago. The soundtrack for the movie has had a life of its own apart from the movie. This is where it gets crazy to me. The video of the Let It Go scene that's been removed from the movie that Disney put on YouTube has been viewed about 200 million times. A Google search for Let It Go covers... By cover, it means other people singing a version of Let It Go. If you Google Let It Go covers, it gets more than a billion results. That's how many other people have been inspired to sing their own versions of this song. If you type in the words parody of, and then you take your hands away from the computer, Let It Go is the first thing that pops up as an option. So, all the Weird Al's songs, all those great parodies just are no match for Let It Go. So, it's not just popular among young girls, which are the typical Disney princess-loving demographic. It's just as popular among the parents of those little girls, and among young adults, and of all stripes. So, I've heard stories about schools, public schools, having to create new rules that Let It Go can only be sung outside and at recess. Because of... Obviously, you don't make a rule like that unless there's a big problem, right? You wouldn't bother. Everybody's singing in the hallways and in the classrooms. If you can't stand the song, you should be careful who you admit that to. Because it has many, many fervent devotees. And I think this is many of whom feel the song is really theirs. It has such a personal connection with people that if you criticize the song, you're really getting at who they are. So don't mess with it. Why has it struck such a chord? I think it's a great question. We can talk about that. I'll take a stab at it now, but we can talk about it in the discussion. I want to show you the scene from the movie in which this takes place, but first I need to give you a little bit of a running start to give you the context. Who has seen the movie? Okay, so I may potentially spoil it for some of you. Hopefully you don't care too much. If you really care, you can run from the room with your ears covered. Anyway, there's two sisters, Elsa and Anna, who are princesses in the kingdom of Arendelle, roughly some Nordic, sort of Norwegian maybe kind of place. Elsa, the older sister, who will one day be queen, has magical powers. She can freeze anything around her. She can produce snow and ice out of thin air. She can make snowmen in the summer, that kind of thing. She's unable to fully control her power, and so she accidentally injures her sister Anna when they're playing as young children. She's making piles of snow for her sister, and she zaps her sister in the head by accident. From that point on, Elsa is kept in isolation for the protection of everybody else, particularly her sister. Her power grows, but is viewed as dangerous and uncontrollable. It's a source of shame and sadness and loneliness to her. She's told over and over and over again by her father, the king, that she should conceal, don't feel. Conceal, don't feel. That's sort of a mantra that happens throughout the movie. Conceal, don't feel. Conceal this power that you have that we don't really want anyone to know about. Meanwhile, the younger sister, Anna, has no memory of the accident and doesn't understand why her sister won't play with her anymore. So their parents eventually die, the girls grow up, and it's Elsa's coronation day. She's finally becoming queen. Elsa manages for a time to conceal her secret from the adoring crowds, but gets in an argument with Anna and inadvertently unleashes her power in front of everyone. And in fear and shame, Elsa flees Arendelle. And without knowing, without being aware of it fully, casts the whole kingdom into perpetual winter. So in her wake... Everything is now covered in snow and ice. And so this is the build-up. This is the build-up to Let It Go.
Tonight, not a footprint to receive. kingdom of isolation, and it looks like I'm the queen. The wind is howling like this swirling storm inside. Couldn't keep it in, heaven knows I tried. Don't let them in, don't let them see. Be the good girl you always have to be. Conceal, don't feel, don't let them know.
Sorry. Right. Oh. So, one of the fascinating fun facts that I've discovered in looking into this song is that the entire story, Frozen, was rewritten to fit this song.
Wow.
There's a blogger named Dorian Linsky. He says, "Let It Go is so undeniable that it changes the direction of the movie. When Chris and Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez were commissioned to write Elsa's badass song..." the Snow Queen was a more conventional villain, but the song's emotional power forced a rethink. The minute we heard the song for the first time, I knew that I had to rewrite the whole movie, says director Jennifer Lee. That's pretty potent songwriting. So because of the song, Elsa, the Snow Queen's whole character is portrayed as a flawed but very sympathetic character, you know, rather than the more stereotypical villain who just wants to freeze everybody. So I'm going to kind of just walk through the song a little bit. And basically, the song it has a total transformation from the beginning to the end, and it actually is quite masterful how it's written, I think, and how it communicates that. The beginning, even the image of her on the mountain. I mean, visually, the animation is spectacular. No one can deny that. But the image of her as this little speck on the mountainside, total this image of complete isolation and loneliness. The snow glows white on the mountain tonight, not a footprint to be seen, except her own. A kingdom of isolation, and it looks like I'm the queen. So isolation in the beginning of the song is still a sad thing. It's conceived as negative. It looks like I'm the queen is a sarcastic comment. Like, I'm great. I'm the queen of my own personal kingdom. I'm the only person. It's an expression of loneliness and loss. The wind is howling like this swirling storm inside. Couldn't keep it in. Heaven knows I tried. And then she transitions to this kind of rote repeating what she's always heard from her father, which is, don't let them in. Don't let them see. Be the good girl you always have to be. Conceal. Don't feel. Don't let them know. Well, now they know, and this is the turning point. It's clear that to conceal and not to feel is pointless now. Everybody knows already, so screw it. Let's go for it, basically. Let's let it go. Anyway, let it go, let it go. Can't hold it back anymore. Let it go, let it go. Turn away and slam the door. It's interesting to think of all the things she's letting go. What does that mean, let it go? She's certainly letting go of all the feelings of shame she's had. She's letting go of being controlled by other people's expectations of her, the experience of being defined by other people's restrictions of her, fear of being found out, she's letting go, everybody knows, fear of hurting and disappointing others, but she's also letting go, it refers in a positive way to her own power, let it go as in let your own creativity go, unleash your self-expression completely. Let it out. Find your voice. Finally be yourself. And then she sings, I don't care what they're going to say. Let the storm rage on. The cold never bothered me anyway. So she's also letting other people go. And this is something that is hard to ignore. She's basically slamming the door on actual people, including her sister, who she has supposedly been trying not to hurt all these years. And she's letting go of all of her responsibilities and obligations as queen as well. She says, it's funny how some distance makes everything seem small. The fears that once controlled me can't get to me at all. So she has distance from other people's judgment, yes, but also other people's problems seem small to her at this point as well, right? The chaos that she's unleashed in her sister's life as well as in her own kingdom doesn't seem to matter because she's gotten distance and it seems small. And the cold doesn't bother her. In fairness, she doesn't realize that she's cast the whole kingdom under a wall of ice yet. She finds that out a little later. But in any case, she's not really thinking about anything that she's left behind at this point. And then my personal favorite line, which is, it's time to see what I can do to test the limits and break through. No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free. So this is... it's almost a textbook definition of the word autonomy, which means a law unto oneself. Oh yeah, sorry. Thank you for saying. no right, no wrong, no rules for me. A law unto oneself. It's also, we were talking about this last week, in a discussion about identity, but, there's an image of the romantic artist that comes about in the 1800s. The image is of the genius, the artist who really, in order to experience true freedom, has to defy all rules, including moral norms. And the creativity of the genius cannot be restricted, shouldn't be expected to be restricted by the rules that apply to other people who are ordinary. And so it's almost a perfect articulation of that as well. Elsa has an enormous creative gift. Nothing should stifle her self-expression. Categories of right and wrong don't and shouldn't apply to her. So let it go, let it go. I'm one with the wind and sky. Let it go, let it go. You'll never see me cry. So she's achieved her goal, or so she thinks, of having no regrets at all. Here I stand, and here I'll stay. Let the storm rage on. I was wondering whether the "here I stand" thing was a reference to Martin Luther. I don't think it is. But if you go online, one Lutheran geek, I suppose, wrote a Martin Luther version of the song, all because of this line, "here I stand." And so it's all about sort of warring with the corruption of the Catholic Church at the time. It's not good. So don't waste your time. My power flurries through the air. This is the bridge, this is where she starts to actually build her palace, which is this incredibly jacked up scene where the ice is rising up from the ground. My power flurries through the air into the ground. My soul is spiraling in frozen fractals all around. And one thought crystallizes like an icy blast. I'm never going back. The past is in the past. And then the chorus again, let it go, I'll rise like the break of dawn, let it go, that perfect girl is gone. And this is, interestingly, when she says that perfect girl is gone, that's the moment when Elsa gives herself this sexy makeover, which has been commented on by thousands of people. Fabulously wind-tossed hair, a slit-to-the-thigh dress, seemingly an increase in bra size, not that I've pay attention to these things too much, but lots of people have been writing about this. And interesting, there was one really, really articulate, interesting blogger or a film critic that, sort of a feminist-minded writer, this is the only thing that she found problematic in the whole scene. It was basically that you're reducing this moment of self-discovery to just physical beauty and anyway, so that was very telling, I thought. I'm like, the whole thing bothers me. That's what bothers you, really? Anyway, here I stand in the light of day. Let the storm rage on. The cold never bothered me anyway. And that's when the doors slam in your face at the end of the scene. So, overall message, we can remain unaffected by our isolation, essentially. We can only maybe truly be ourselves in isolation. And the isolation that was the source of sadness in the very beginning, remember when she's the only footprints on the mountain are her own, it was a source of sadness in the beginning. By the end, it's a condition for happiness and wholeness. I don't want anybody else around. So other people and their expectations are only unbearable limitations on her freedom. And so she has this kind of perverse joy in her isolation. Later on in the movie, in a dialogue song between her sister and her, she says, "I'm alone, but I'm alone and free." So, Elsa has remade herself and is a new person. She's literally reconstructed herself, her identity, and sort of triumphantly, defiantly faces the dawn with her makeover, needing no one and nothing except to be left alone. Dana Stevens, who's actually the movie critic I mentioned a second ago, she says this: Elsa flees to the mountains and there undergoes the kind of transformation that only a pop diva can, letting loose with the empowerment anthem "Let It Go" as she dares to own for the first time her fabulous frozenness. That's a great summary of what happens. I've always wondered what she's going to eat up there. She doesn't eat. She doesn't have to eat. That's true. Yeah. And so what's I think it's easy to see kind of what the appeal of this is. I mean, it shouldn't be a mystery to us at this point that this appeals to sort of contemporary Americans, Westerners even. It's popular in England as well, evidently. One of the brilliant things about the song is how flexible it is, I think, and how a diversity of people can identify with it and see themselves in it. That's probably the key to how popular it is. All kinds of different people feel that they can own the message of the song. It's about them. It's telling themselves about themselves. It was written for them and to them. Two examples. One blogger wrote, the song "Let It Go" is an aperitif for adolescence. Essentially, something that whets the appetite of young people for what they'll experience in adolescence, which is a time when boundaries will be pushed and parental rules will be questioned and all this kind of thing. And so all these little kids are just completely jazzed by this song. It's sort of this intoxicating foretaste of maybe what they'll experience as they grow older and can actually affect the world around them more. Interestingly, it's been claimed as an anthem by some people in the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual community. The movie as a whole, but particularly this song, this moment where, metaphorically speaking, Elsa comes out, celebrates who she is after a life of keeping a secret and living in shame and fear about who she is. And so a blogger named Justin Lee, a Christian blogger who's also a homosexual, wrote this. If you want to understand what it's like as a family member who has a gay sibling or a gay family member, look at the character of Anna, the sister who's trying to figure out what's going on with her estranged sister Elsa, struggling to understand, struggling to reach out, but not really sure what's going on. Needless to say, Disney has not come out and said that this is the subtext of the film, and they never will. The song has a much more broad appeal than this. So these are just two examples of its flexibility, right? That people can hear it and say, oh, that's me. It affirms a particular view of the self that I think many of us want to be true. It's kind of tailor-made for modern Americans. But I think one of the things that happens here is that it offers us false choices. It's the first false choice that it offers is to either feel or conceal, right? This is the mantra that she's told her whole life. We can either conceal or we can feel. To conceal means you are to suppress who you are, hide and pretend in an inauthentic way. It means you're controlled by other people's expectations of you. It means you're not really being yourself. You're concealing who you really are. It's a life of dishonesty. It's a life of suppression. It's an unhappy life. That's one option that's presented to us. The other option is you can feel, right? And those are the only two options that are offered to us, which is to reject all limitations put on you by relationships, chuck all stifling obligations out the window that don't produce good feelings. That's actually literally what Elsa does. She takes her crown off, which is like the symbol of her responsibility, and she whips it out off the mountain like a frisbee. It's only by doing this that we can truly be ourselves, essentially what we're being shown here. So either to conceal or feel. There's a line from a recent pop song called Raging Fire, and it's just articulates this in two lines. Hold on to what makes you feel. Don't let go. It's what makes you real. So what we feel, feeling intensely, this ability to feel life intensely, is what gives us our identity, what makes us real. So we can only truly find ourselves, express ourselves, discover ourselves in this kind of isolation, getting away from the expectations that other people place on us, which limit us. Like the Kelly Clarkson song, just me, myself, and I. That's the only way I can truly be myself. So the choice being offered in Let It Go is between total unfettered freedom and being oppressed and confined. And those are not the only two options. We can talk about that more later. The other false choice, I think, being offered is between freedom and responsibility. That responsibility is necessarily in opposition to freedom, that freedom is necessarily in opposition to responsibility. And this is there's actually a legacy of Disney songs throughout Disney history that dwell on this theme. Anyone remember The Bear Necessities? Yeah, Baloo the Bear. It's basically about lowering your expectations for life, because expectations just make more work for you. Find out what you really, really, really need and just worry about that. And live the lazy life. Forget about your troubles and your strife. So that's one example. A number of years later, I think it's actually just had its 20th anniversary, The Lion King. Someone in a blog, I forget her name, pointed out this helpful thing. The song Hakuna Matata. This song is more specifically about abandoning responsibilities that stress you out and telling yourself it's all good. No worries. No problem. In one scene, I've found on YouTube, the meerkat Timon, the little guy who sings the song, he sings, "It's our problem-free philosophy, Hakuna Matata." And while he's singing this, he's filing the lion's claws off, which is really significant, I think, in the story. It's like, you don't need these. he's also probably afraid of them himself. But what do you need these for? It's all good. It's fascinating to me that the Lion King story itself never could progress and reach its resolution unless the main character, Simba, renounces Hakuna Matata. So Hakuna Matata is not where the movie ends. He has to actually renounce it and return with all his strength to his kingdom, which is in shambles. There would be no happy ending or no happily ever after at all if Hakuna Matata was the last word, right? It signifies a distraction from the story. But Hakuna Matata was the song that everyone came away singing, right? it's one of the things that sold the movie. So one of the hit songs, essentially, of the film communicates the opposite message of the story. It really resonated with people, and they knew it would resonate with people. And I think something similar is going on in the song "Let It Go," as it stands in relation to the story "Frozen." Many people have observed, rightly, that the hit song of the movie is a stark contradiction to the movie's message, to the actual story's message. In a similar way to Hakuna Matata and The Lion King, the message of the movie is actually, I think, quite a good one. I actually like this movie. Maybe I have to, given my family, but there's a lot of good things about it. As Disney stories go, it's a very good one, I think. It's one of those examples of how the power of the Christian story is borrowed to make other stories good. And this is my spoiler. This is my spoiler alert. Basically, in the very beginning, there's peace and harmony. Elsa and Anna are friends, close friends. Elsa uses her power to entertain and play with her sister. Then something goes horribly wrong. There's disintegration and loss of relationship. The sisters are estranged from each other. The problem deepens, and there's a curse that descends on the land. And to make matters worse, Anna's heart is frozen, so her life is her days are numbered. The problem deepens again. There's a prophecy made that the curse can only be removed by some supreme act of love. And the filmmakers, I think, are really, really clever in this, because there's a way in which they build up the expectation that the problems of the story will be solved by romantic love. There'll be a kiss, perhaps, that will undo the curse. Surely all the clouds will disperse with true love's kiss. It's clever because they're playing with expectations that have been built up by dozens of other Disney movies, right? This is what we expect when we watch a Disney movie. There's going to be some sort of romantic solution for all the problems. But in a twist, cover your ears if you haven't seen it, it's Anna's willingness to actually die for her sister that breaks the curse. And she does die for her sister, releasing the land from the ice and bringing her sister's power under control, finally. And there's even a resurrection of sorts when, actually, after dying for her sister, Anna comes back to life and is fully healed. And peace is restored. Relationships are made whole again. Elsa's powers are used for good, and they're under control. And she becomes the good queen, who doesn't have any secrets anymore, but she's actually ruling well. All this through an act of self-sacrificial love. So this is a good story, right? I think. However, the song "Let It Go" communicates precisely the opposite message in every way. Within the context of the story, Elsa's attitude in the song is just plain wrong. It's a complex situation. We have sympathy for her. It's not clear what her options are. Everyone wants to string her up at this point, but she sort of has to run away. We sympathize, but as a character in the story, the sentiments expressed in "Let It Go" are a mistake, right? It's actually, interestingly, it's Anna's commitment to not let go, but to rather doggedly pursue her sister that leads to the redemptive ending. And so in the end, Elsa herself repudiates the sentiments of her own hit song. But the tricky bit is the song has been blatantly marketed and presented by Disney as an inspirational song. Right? from the beginning, it's obvious that this is the song that's intended to be the big hit in the movie. This is the song that's going to sell the movie. It's the hook, you know. You talk about a hook in a pop song, which is the part that sells the song. This song is the hook for the whole movie. Dana Stevens, she actually writes for Slate magazine. She says, even the umpteenth time through, and even though in plot terms, this is the moment when she is basically assuming the role of villain, it's impossible not to thrill at Elsa's surging sense of power as she throws off the gloves the late king always made her wear to hide her natural gifts and cast them into the raging storm. So there's a tension here, right? This is her moment of villainhood, in a sense. But it's inspirational to us. So as the movie ends, after we've seen how destructive the sentiments of the song really are, and everything's been healed, and everything's been brought to peace again, the credits come up, and what's the song that blasts? It's Let It Go Again, right? Because that's the song that sells the movie. So we have to ask which virtues are being espoused? Which constitutes a heroic act? Is it self-expression no matter what the cost to others? Or is it self-sacrificial love no matter what the cost to oneself? Anna's pursuing love and Elsa's withdrawal in her ice palace can't both be examples of human excellence because they're in complete opposition to each other. Which one? Which one is it? But surprise, they are presented as heroic, both, by the movie makers. Because they, I think, this is me being cynical, but I think you need both to sell the movie. A song about denying yourself and living sacrificially or practicing self-control and being responsible is not going to sell as an inspirational song. To modern Americans, anyway. But neither is a story that ends by glorifying self-expression at the expense of others. No one wants a story that ends that way either. That does not lead to peace and resolution. That's estrangement. So the movie never could have ended with the scene, Let It Go. Because it produces tension. It signifies estrangement of people from each other. Kids would have left the cinema crying. Yet, the song is intentionally giving us a picture of what the good life should look like, somehow. So kids, and thankfully, the story resolves nicely. So kids leave the movie not crying, but singing "Let It Go," right? Which is just completely, many levels of irony. So basically, we're being offered. The filmmakers are offering to satisfy two deep desires that we have, that actually can't be satisfied at the same time: the desire for total personal freedom and autonomy, that's realized only by being alone. And the deep desire for a happy ending, which means restored relationship, reconciliation between people, being known and loved. We seem to want both of those. And so Disney is there to give it to us, both. In some ways, I'm thankful for the movie because it presents, I think, the clash of these two obsessions very well, although I don't think many people are noticing. I think people love the message of the movie and they love the song Let It Go. So... I'm drawing to a close here. I'm realizing that a lot has to be said from a Christian perspective, a biblical perspective, and I have to shortchange this section a little bit because it's been going quite long. But I'm just going to throw out a handful of possible kind of one-liners without much analysis. And we can talk about it more in the discussion if you like. What is a Christian response to some of the things we've been talking about? And these are very inadequately brief, but we were actually made to have dignity and dominion, which is a good thing, but not to be a law unto ourselves. There's a distinction between those two things. The God-given dignity and dominion of each person is abused in many relationships. I'm thinking more of the breakup songs at this point. But this is part of the fall. Creative self-expression is a good thing, but its purpose is loving communication with others and worship of God. So there's nothing wrong with self-expression. Artistic self-expression, creative self-expression. But its purpose is communication. It's not... its purpose is not the indulging of the ego at the expense of all relationships. If self-expression is going to be communication, it needs to seek to be understood on some level. It needs to seek to reach out to people. Another one-liner. We should not expect to discover anything true about ourselves in isolation from other people. It's in relationships that we see ourselves most clearly. Isolation from input of a community does not lead to clarity of self-perception, but leads to self-deception very often. We can believe all kinds of things that aren't true that other people could point out to us in 2 seconds. We are made for relationship with God, first and foremost, and with other people. That you can only be yourself when all ties of responsibility and obligation are severed and you're in isolation, this is a lie. This is not true. Real freedom only exists within certain parameters, we could say. There's a helpful analogy that Tim Keller has used somewhere. Basically saying, is a fish that breaks the restrictive prison of the water and flops onto the land free? Is that what we call freedom? Is freedom consist of breaking every barrier and being rid of all restrictions? Is that what freedom is? Well, if you take a fish out of the water and put it in a field, it's free. Right? Free of the water. But no, that's obviously not what freedom is. You take a fish out of the water, it's dead. It dies. So similarly, freedom is only to be found in obedience to God, who actually made us and knows what we were made for. Even if you look at one example of biblical parameters, if you look at the Ten Commandments, we had a guest preacher recently at our church who pointed out that the Ten Commandments begin with, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, the land of slavery. And then it goes on, you will have no other gods before me. But it's really significant that the beginning of the Ten Commandments is, I brought you out of slavery. And he was arguing that that sets the tone of the whole thing. I am the God that brought you out of slavery, and therefore, first of all, you should obey me because I did this. But second of all, this is how you live in order to maintain that freedom. These are the parameters within which you're supposed to live that lead to human flourishing. I know, because I made you. We're to understand even the Ten Commandments, which can be interpreted so just in terms of legalism, do this, and don't do that. Actually, this is how we live in order to remain free. God has made us free. This is how we should remain free. Whatever we experience by isolating ourselves and rejecting all limitations, it won't be freedom, actually. Lastly, in Christian terms, growth might not look like a discovery of new personal strength. I think that's the assumption behind every song we've listened to, is that somehow we move from strength to strength to strength in ourselves. You know, we find out how powerful and awesome we are. In Christian terms, growth might mean growth in humility. Actually, it does mean growth in humility, which means a heightened awareness of our weakness, our tendency to hurt the people we love, and our vulnerability to being hurt ourselves. This is the more we realize that, actually, that is what Christian growth is. Perhaps we should be seeking shalom rather than self-actualization. Shalom being a very holistic well-being that rests on a relationship with our Creator. It implies a peace that is to be found in awareness of dependence, not in our ability to secure our own needs, but in our dependence on God. So the Christian life is less a journey of self-discovery, although we will discover things about ourselves, not all good. Rather, it's a process of accepting who God says we are. And so it is primarily not an endeavor of self-definition. It's an endeavor to believe and have faith in God's definition of who we are, which is precious creatures made by Him, valued by Him, and ultimately accepted by Him in our brokenness because of what Christ has done for us. That's what the Christian, if we're going to think about life in terms of a journey and we're Christians, that's more what we should be thinking. Growing in our faith in God's definition of who we are. And actually, I believe it's only within the Christian faith that real freedom and a real happy ending can both be enjoyed. Which, as we were saying earlier, Disney tries to offer us a false version of both of those, which can't really coexist. But within the Christian story, real freedom in Christ is possible, and a real happy ending is inevitable. It actually will come through what Christ has done. That's where I'm going to end. And again, I apologize for how just kind of swift the last section is, but I wanted to leave some time for discussion and about anything that we've been talking about so far. If you need to go, feel free. It's fine to leave right now, but anyone who wants to stay can stay and ask questions or make comments. Any questions? The one, the video that you watch? Yeah. There's no doubt about, I think, the quality of the songwriting. It's very well written, yeah. And the music. And one of the things that's, I think, brilliant about the song is that it's not just a steady kind of ascent in terms of the intensity of the music and the volume and the dynamics and all that stuff. It builds and builds and builds, and then the first chorus, which we expect to be really big, is very quiet. Because the character is still discovering what she can do, and she's not completely bought into this new identity, and so it's let it go, let it go. She's doing it, but by the second time the chorus comes around, it's just, it's huge. And it's, basically the song accomplishes a lot in a very short period of time. It accomplishes a total transformation of a character. So, it's very well written. A lot of the songs in the movie are well written, I would say. A lot of the songs in the movie are very well written. Yeah. Anybody?
I forgot where I heard this, but a lot of modern pop songs are kind of designed with the music to kind of what you mentioned earlier to give a rise to certain neurotransmitters. I think serotonin to make people feel good about themselves while listening to the song.
Yeah. No, I believe it. Whether that is consciously orchestrated or whether it's just something people have learned from writing songs for a long time, what tends to move us and what doesn't. I'm sure there's lots of neurological explanations for what's going on. You're right. What is it that's going on neurologically when we feel our heart swelling to a song that we know is totally not true? What's going on there? Yeah. I feel that with the Katy Perry song in particular. The Katy Perry song is so huge and so it's motivational. So that's why it was written. it's a little bit hard. The one thing I was saying about some of these songs as a corrective, it's a little hard to take Katy Perry too seriously as having a feminist consciousness, because the vast majority of her songs are, you know, let's go all the way tonight, baby kind of songs. So it's, anyway, Dick, did you have something?
The idea of the tension between the song and the overall theme of the film is an interesting one. Reminds me of something we talked about before, that people have often talked about Milton's Paradise Lost. Mm-hmm. Satan was by far and away a more interesting character than God. And much more drama, much more human connection. Mm-hmm. And so on. And some people have said, Stanley Fish among them, some people have said that that's just the case, that Satan is always more interesting than God. One very postmodern literary critic says, Milton knew exactly what he was doing, and he was communicating in that to you, your own greater attractiveness to things satanic than things to do with the Lord. And so it was actually a challenge and
a to the reader.
Yeah, an appeal to repentance and to at least self-awareness.
Right.
But throughout literature, it seems to me, you have this, it's much easier to make evil, selfishness,
the autonomous dynamic attractive, imaginatively attractive, compelling, and much, much easier than to make goodness. And this is where Liddy's, your talk coming up is perfectly timed.
It's
her talk, The Goodness of Goodness and the Evil of Evil. Will be really interesting, because that's what C.S. Lewis, I think, is good at. But what a huge challenge it is to make the self-sacrifice and love as imaginatively engaging as the kick-ass kind of kick over all the traces. People would want to have me in. And all
It's true. It reminds me of the number of years ago when Danny and I lectured on the Dark Knight Batman movie. And when we were trying to divide up what we were going to say, I got to talk about the Joker. Which I was really relieved that I got that part. And other students at the time were like, oh, you got the cool part. Like, that's the interesting one. That's the interesting character. That's the character that made the movie interesting, right? Batman, whatever you do. The Joker, that is a truly compelling, interesting, fascinating character to reflect on. It's a similar type of thing, I think. My fear is that critique was a Stanley Fish, that critique that maybe, you know, Milton is writing in order to cause the reader to reflect on their own attraction to this. Mm-hmm. That's not happening with that.
No.
Nobody is stopping to question, like, wait a second, why do I find this antisocial song so appealing? Oh, no. Like, what's wrong with me? It's like...
Don't forget her.
That certainly wasn't the intention. It's just the opposite in terms of the intention of the movie. Yeah.
It's ironic that they're often used in very social settings. Like, you dance to that song.
Yeah. And sing it together with other people.
I was so struck when our family was all together. Our three granddaughters, including your two daughters, perform that. They absolutely, and they know it, and they sing it, and they perform it, you know, with all emotions. And I just was wondering how you talk to them about it, because they know you've been working on a lecture.
Yeah, I talked to them about it a lot. They know exactly how I feel about the song. I think this is an important thing to bring up.
How to talk to children about this.
Yeah, to what extent do we, because on the one hand you could say, it's just a pop song, get over it. They're just singing, you know, everybody's singing this, it's just a fun thing, they're just having fun. And they are. On one level, like, great. On the other hand, they are filling their imaginations with something that's a total lie. They're just, and it's not, again, it's on the level of imagination and the heart and the desires, all these things that swell up in us, and that's appealing, that's what the good life is, that's desirable. I think in a lot of cases, I'm inexperienced, I've never seen anything like this as a parent. My hunch is to completely put a kibosh on it and have no frozen listening just makes it more appealing. Plus, they're going to hear it every time they see a friend. What we've done is basically watch the movie with them, and I've talked to them about how what the song is saying isn't what the movie is saying, and they see what the end is about. They see what that one of the sisters is willing to die for the other, and that's what brings healing, and that's an expression of what love is. And so they get it, and we talk about it quite a bit, and then I just kind of have to roll with it and not try to make a big deal out of it. I think there's more to be gained from presenting other positive pictures of what goodness is than saying, oh, stop that song, don't do it, because that has a way of backfiring.
Criticizing something you love.
Right. And it's very personal. I mean, you see, if you go online and you look at comments that moms have made about this song, you'll get deluged in... basically the experience of, you don't mess with your kid's experience of this. Like, you're in the car and you start singing along with it, they tell you, shut up, it's their song. and don't sing the wrong parts. So, you know, there's this kind of ownership of the song. If you critique it, you're really I mean, obviously some of this is bad parenting. but
is it all girls, not boys? Do boys are boys into the song, or is it only girls?
Not as much as girls, I don't think, but I think a lot of boys are into it. I mean, I sing along with some of it.
Noah
doesn't have a choice. I mean, he has two older sisters. He doesn't have a choice. He knows a lot of it. Yeah.
Yeah, my comments won't be entirely consistent. I've got some mixed feelings here. But I'm going to push back a little bit.
Okay.
First, one comment on the side. You talked about the... how I'm made stronger by all this stuff that's happened.
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of a throwaway comment before I get to my main point. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Christians who say, all things, God causes all things to work for good. Mm-hmm. Some people would take that in the redemptive sense. God is a redeeming God, causes all things to good.
Yeah.
But some people just simply quote it as, all things work together for good. That God's this grand puppeteer. No matter what happens in your life, it's all to prepare you for heaven. Nothing right. to do with it. So I'll just.
There's no such thing as moral failure or something like that.
There's no such thing as a battle between good and evil.
Yeah.
This is all God somehow preparing you for heaven.
Yeah.
But that's a very similar thought, which I think has infected some Christianity. That's one. But now I'm going to push back on the other one about the. Are you familiar with a book called The Gifts of the Jews?
I don't know it.
One of its thesis is that before in Mesopotamia, the religion, where Abraham came from,
mm-hmm.
before Abraham, the religion was that the world was a great circle. You were either on a wheel going up and really going down. It was just a big cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And the highest religious good was to understand your position in it and be content.
Okay. Yeah.
And Abraham was called in a linear path to lead. He had a destiny.
Mm-hmm.
A person had a destiny. And here's where the pushback begins. I look at the prodigal son
mm-hmm.
and the elder son. The elder son followed the rules, but never internalized them. The younger son, and I'm not making a case for sin that grace may abound,
mm-hmm.
but the younger son, when he was done,
mm-hmm.
knew something of the father's love that the older son never did.
Absolutely.
I would propose that Moses, when he discovered his power, killed an Egyptian, fled from the desert,
mm-hmm.
that spent some time alone,
mm-hmm.
Confronting who he was,
mm-hmm.
came back, redeemed. I would say, suggest that Joseph,
yeah.
kind of flexed his muscle in inadequate ways and
mm-hmm.
and learned something.
Yeah.
I would suggest that Paul, when
yeah.
he first met Jesus, had to get lowered in a basket because he loved arguing and beating them.
Mm-hmm.
And he was lowered over the wall.
Mm-hmm.
You have all of the sense of a bursting forth in adolescence, making mistakes,
mm-hmm.
exactly the way the world
yeah.
works.
Yeah.
We learn by making mistakes.
Yeah.
And something in Christ allows us to make those mistakes
yeah.
without shame, being forgiven, and move forward. And I'm not making a case, let's go deliberately make mistakes.
Of course not, yeah.
But I'm making a case of... And so some of these songs I see as a bursting forth of that freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And I would challenge you to come up with... It isn't exciting to be suppressed by rules externally,
yeah.
which you don't understand.
Yeah.
And I think it's a myth to believe that, I'm an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
I see a lot of trial and error in the physical world.
Mm-hmm.
Am I to believe that the creative God of this universe thinks in the spiritual world, here are the rules, you follow them exactly, and everything's going to work out. That makes you the hero.
Mm-hmm.
No sense of good works prepared beforehand. I
mm-hmm.
don't know how to...
Yeah.
No sense of exploration.
Can I jump in real quick and then?
Yeah, I'm done.
I would agree with everything you just said. Absolutely, I would say that my critique of a lot of these songs are not that I'm stronger as a result of realizing my mistakes and learning from them. I haven't found a single mistake acknowledged in any of these songs.
Okay, fair enough.
I think the problem is it's a belief of the self which is so. Compelling that we are autonomous and that we're headed for greatness no matter what, that I can't even look at a broken relationship and see the ways in which I've screwed it up. It's all this stupid person's fault and I'm awesome. And so that is not a picture of growth in any sense.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
that's
you.
That's
I appreciate
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
That's a good answer.
Because I would totally agree with what you're saying about Christian growth comes through making mistakes and hitting the ground and realizing that we are completely unable to do it on our own, and that God is there with grace.
Yeah. That's good. That was helpful.
That's a helpful clarification, because
it's a huge theology of suffering as a means of growth.
Right.
In the Bible, without making it a happy, happy, you know, everything's beautiful, but a huge theme close to what makes us grow is when things don't work out for us the way we hoped
right.
they would. Strips idols away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Todd.
I came in, I guess, just near the beginning of the song. I've seen this thing before that, but it seemed to me that Tony's done so beautifully, and sung so beautifully, but it seemed to be saying that that I was in a prison,
mm-hmm.
other people's expectations of me,
mm-hmm.
other people's rules, and other people's my situation I'm in, and everything else, especially other people's rules, they were keeping me bound in prison,
mm-hmm.
enclosed in a small room I couldn't get through.
Yeah.
Now I'm saying I'm breaking out of that. I'm not going to be imprisoned by other people,
mm-hmm.
or by other things, or by, you know, enclosed in a little room. And that's very good. I mean, she shouldn't be imprisoned by other people's rules,
mm-hmm.
and expectations. Who's to say they're right anyway?
Mm-hmm.
And then I also even thought of Paul's writings about being no longer under the law,
mm-hmm.
but free of that. In other words, I'm not bound by these all these little rules, here, so to speak.
Yeah.
I can be free and be break out of my confinement.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of the way I looked at the song.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no doubt in the movie. One of the things that makes Elsa such a sympathetic character is that her isolation is really sad. Like, in the beginning of the movie, she really is in a prison. She can't talk to anybody. She's sitting alone in this room that's, like, blasted with ice. And she's just, like with her back against the door. And so that it makes that scene all the more cathartic, that she's finally not in prison anymore. And which is true. I mean that's I think, fair enough. But the question is, what does she therefore conclude? And is that the place where she's supposed to be forever? Is just in a different kind of isolation. Just an isolation in which she's flexing her muscles, as opposed to an isolation where she's hiding in the room. And
if
so
she chooses to be alone, she's making her own isolation, is that what she's saying?
Yeah. And before it was self-imposed, and before it was imposed by other people, but the song is like transitioning to self-imposed isolation. I would hesitate to compare it to Paul's language of being sort of freed from the law, in that he is now subject to the law of grace. He's just under a different law, a different understanding of what law is. Whereas Elsa is, there are no rules for me. There's no right. There's no such thing as right and wrong for me, except what I decide. Which isn't really what Paul can think to, but
so we continue and send the grace way of hell. Boy, we're gonna continue on that way. Yeah.
Mary Frances, did you have something to say?
Yeah, it's going in a different direction. I'm just pulling back off of Frozen a little bit, thinking about all the songs we did. I was just struck by your comment that these are all sung by women,
mm-hmm.
and then the corrective, the sort of which I think is an interesting point, and this isn't really a question, I'm just sort of thinking out loud a little bit, but with all these things, including Frozen, pop music, think about Taylor Swift, she writes all of her own music, right,
mm-hmm.
so it's not like being piped out of some factory and she sings it, like,
mm-hmm.
she talks very much about how the music that she writes, whether you like it or not, is born out of her own life experience, and so just thinking about that as, this music as sort of a creative expression, but yet, pop music and film it's so tied to this commercialism and money making schema, and not scheme, but just that, you know, that whole idea. And so you brought up Rihanna, and I find her quite interesting because she has a very, this very public, had this very public relationship with Chris Brown, where she was physically abused. It was very public. She was interviewed by Oprah. It was a whole thing. But she also has a song that was on the top 10 charts called S&M that is about this very physically violent, that I think, if I remember correctly, came out after the incident with Chris Brown. And then she recently, just in the last couple of weeks, was at some kind of award show or some kind of thing, I can't remember what it was, where the dress that she wore was essentially
the see-through dress.
She essentially wore a transparent dress. And I read a few, just a few things online about that. If people, do you think it's a good idea or not? And the, you know, the vast majority of people are like, you know, she's celebrating her womanhood, she's celebrating her freedom, she's celebrating the beauty, she's not bound by what people think she should be, whatever.
Who are we to put it in?
Who are we, right? And I mean, I can't even parse it all out of my head. There's like so many layers to this. But I also just wonder about, like, thinking about Katy Perry, thinking about Britney Spears, thinking about Taylor Swift, and what their public personas are, physically, what they look like, how they present themselves in their videos, on stage. Not as you, I mean, you know, Taylor Swift, I think, her videos are a very different category than Britney Spears. So there's a difference there, for sure. But this freedom, in many ways, a very overt, blatant, in-your-face sexuality, that also, I just think of, like, the lyrics of the songs of theoretically coming out of, coming out from under the weight of a man's
abuse.
Abuse, heavy-handedness, whatever. But yet,
still using sex to sell songs.
As artists, they're selling sex to sell their songs in a very blatant, explicit way, labeled as freedom. I mean, I'm even thinking of a couple years ago when Beyonce did the halftime show at the Super Bowl. And there was this whole, again, this whole back and forth of, like, was that just selling them in, or was that her freedom as a woman? And
women are free to demean themselves in public.
Exactly. It's still coming under sort of this idea of, from a man's perspective, what it means to be a woman, a powerful woman, a strong woman, and so there's a real, I mean, those things are at cross purposes for me, and then underlying all of it is selling things and making more money. There's no question that it's just
I mean, I think it's Katy Perry's kind of videos, I think, make the sort of women's empowerment kind of message sort of laughable for her. I mean, to me, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of hilarious that I did this lecture because I really don't know a lot about pop music and about a lot of this stuff. I've sort of delved into it a bit more recently, but I would say someone like Taylor Swift is, at least the public perception of her as being more of the good girl. And Kelly Clarkson, too. They're both, their videos are not as just ridiculously provocative. And they're not using, they're certainly using sexuality to sell things, but not in the just overt, sort of shameless way that Britney Spears and Katy Perry do. that's just my opinion.
And the Katy Perry's The Roar song, you pointed out, it has kind of all those boxing images. You know, so in some ways it's very sort of male, masculine kind of thing, but yet you look at her, or you look at visually how this presented, and it's totally other.
The video is really dope, that's a good one.
Most of those pop songs are actually written by groups of men.
Yeah.
Almost Britney Spears writes
nothing.
Basically groups of men writing.
Did you have a question over here?
I have, maybe it's more of a comment, but I really liked what you had to say about people being sort of either aids to our self-actualization or stumbling blocks to them. I've often been kind of astonished at how frequently, after a breakup of a relationship, people will either despise or dislike one another, or or just not want to have anything to do with each other, and not just when those relationships were like really hurtful or abusive, but that when like one person, for one reason or another, the relationship ends, the person who's the offended party, or the person who gets dumped, basically. Someone's calling me. I'm gonna talk to their voice now. The person who gets dumped basically has this kind of resentment of this person for basically hurting them by not wanting to be in a relationship with them. Yeah. And that seemed really bizarre to me that you just wouldn't want to have anything to do with this person or just like totally resent them.
Contempt.
Because and it makes me sort of think like, was the relationship really about you loving and caring for this other person? Or is it about what this relationship gave to you and how great it was for you?
And if it was loving the other person, there'd be a very different experience of loss.
Right. You'd be sad and care for them and they matter.
Yeah. Or it may realistically, you may really have loved this other person, and it may be painful and difficult to even talk to them because that was real. It's very complicated. You get the sense from, obviously these songs don't describe real life perfectly, but you get the sense that there's like this mechanical switch. It goes to just like, I'm obsessed with you, contempt, I hate you, you're an idiot, you're terrible. You get that certainly with more of the sort of vindictive breakup songs. They're just really, really brutal in their lyrics.
Yeah. But I wonder how much of that isn't, I mean, and this happens in real life too, not just some breakup songs, but isn't whether a really a big factor in that is because people in our time and culture move so fast to so much sexual intimacy that to basically experiencing doing together what in the past has been seen as in the context of a marriage commitment, of a lifelong commitment, that there is profound hurt. There's something that something's, so it's not so surprising. I mean, if one has gone very slowly and carefully in a relationship and then decided, no, this isn't going somewhere, it's going to be less hurt than if a couple is, you know, in bed together within a few dates and then decide a while later, or you know, that this isn't going anywhere.
Yeah.
There's just going to be more
less
hurt.
Severed.
Yeah, there's going to be more hurt, and therefore more, you know, all kinds of negative emotions.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that's probably one factor anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, breakups.
But yet at the same time, this message that sex is insignificant and just
right.
It's very complicated to live in the world today and try to make sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly if you don't have some sort of moral framework for understanding. It's just, how does anyone navigate these things? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've mentioned that all these by women. I wonder if you think the same thing is true of blues. I wouldn't have thought so.
No.
But just what I would have thought it's more egalitarian.
Yeah. It's true, yeah, that's definitely true. There's a whole, I mean, there's, in a sense, probably more, who knows whether this is just because there happens to be more men blues singers, I think blues, by and large, coming from a very different cultural moment and cultural...
Yeah.
Background. It hasn't been pop music for a long time.
That's true.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about the Christian response to this.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if you could talk a bit about forgiveness and its place. It keeps coming to mind, probably partly because that's what I'm studying right now, but how do you think it would help us let some things go in a good sort of healthy way when we are hurt? Intermittent
relationships,
or in general, by people.
That's a very big question. Letting go is not a vague enough, broad enough thing, so we can't say that it's bad in every sense, because, I mean, so much of, I mean, we're supposed to let go of our idols. We're supposed to, in the context of forgiveness, we're supposed to, I mean, forgiveness is all about letting go of our right to hold judgment over somebody else, and being okay with not holding on to that anymore, and somehow, even if we can't forget what someone has done to us, which we can't usually, we're relinquishing the right to hold it over their head and to punish them. Yeah, there's all kinds of there's all kinds of ways in which that could go. Did you have anything more specific you wanted to? Yeah.
I guess not. It's just kind of what you said earlier, just acknowledging how hurtful it is for people.
Yeah.
It just seems like one of the biggest messages that Christianity brings is this possibility of forgiving other people.
Yeah.
Then maybe wouldn't it could help not make all these triumphant breakup songs as necessary, or kind of give a replacement for those sorts of ideas.
You know, I mean, in a way, just the almost tyrannical expectation that every broken relationship will lead to our greater strength, and our, you know, I think that I was saying somewhere in here that it doesn't allow room for remorse and recognizing your own failures. It also doesn't allow room for just lament, basically for experience of sadness, because you have to be awesome, you have to be doing great, and you have to be stronger as a result of what's just happened to you. So if you can't, allowing yourself to grieve something is very often a process of identifying and naming something that's been done wrong to you. And you can't even begin to forgive somebody in any real way until it's clear what's actually being forgiven. You can say, oh, I forgive you, without ever having acknowledged the extent of the damage done, which means you haven't really forgiven the person, you just want some sort of workable peace. I remember hearing, I think it was a teacher at a Christian school not too far away from here, who on September 11th, it was a Tuesday, and a bunch of little kids in the class was completely confused about what was happening, understandably, and we're told that we need to forgive, before anybody even has a clue what's happening. But you know that several thousand people have died on this day already, but I feel like as Christians, like, obviously forgiveness is our goal and our hope that we'll be forgiven ourselves. But we need to be sure that when we forgive, we've acknowledged what's being forgiven, what's gone wrong, that forgiveness is a resolution to. Otherwise, it's very shallow and fake. I don't know what I would have said to a bunch of kids on September 11th, but the rush to forgive before you know, even grown-ups hadn't conceived of what had happened yet.
Just on that, one thing that strikes me is in these songs, they're acknowledging coming out from under someone else's power over them in order to hold their own power. And I think of just the Christian message of forgiveness, a piece of that is coming out from the power that someone or an event or an action would have over us. But we come out from that not to pull ourselves up and hold our own power, but coming under the power of Christ, and the power of what we receive through the sacrifice of Christ, and really the power and the strength that God holds. And that Christ holds, and that we have access to through that.
And forgiveness is all about relinquishing power, actually.
Right.
If we forgive someone, we're letting go of a weapon, right?
I feel like what's happening here is just a transfer of power, right? But it's like I'm taking it out of your hands so that I can hold it.
Yeah.
It's very much this triumphant power, like, it's powerful.
Boxing match.
Yeah, like the boxing match. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
My own strength, my own power, where when we look at forgiveness, it's very much, relinquishing of power and acknowledging that the power and the strength is from God through Christ.
Yeah. Lewis, do you have a hand?
Just like, going this a long time, but like practically, like, you know, in order to forgive in that situation, you kind of need to breathe it properly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how is that going about being bitter or wallowing or whatever? Like, if you.
How is it done? Meaning, how do we appropriately acknowledge the extent of the wrong done? In order to forgive without just becoming bitter and wallowing in it or something. Mm. I mean, I'm sure it's different for everybody, but it's not something that has to happen quickly. Or at least to forgive.
How do you like know when it's become like self-indulgence? Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not sure that's something that I have an answer for that would apply to every situation. I mean, there's certainly people who are more prone to self-pity than other people, and that may be a specific thing that they have to watch out for, that I'm not just cycling around on my suffering here and never breaking out of that. Yeah. I mean, if the person is a Christian, there's... I think that the essential ingredient to ever coming to a place where we can actually forgive somebody else is an awareness that we've been forgiven for something huge that we can't possibly have paid for ourselves. And so that's the ground, I mean, if we're a Christian and thinking as a Christian, that's the ground we're standing on when it comes to forgiveness, in a sense. It's an acknowledgement that no matter how bad this person has hurt me, we are not on radically different ground morally before God. We're both equally in need of mercy. And that's, who knows? I don't know if authentic forgiveness is possible without some awareness of that. Yeah.
You know, picking up on that, there's a Jesus parable of what? The servant who owed, what, 10,000 talents and the one who owed 100 denarius or something?
Yeah.
A lot of times that's preached as the 100 denarius is like the widow's mite and the 10 million talents. But 100 denarius, a denarius is a day's pay.
Mm-hmm.
That's, what, 100 days out of a working year of whatever, or is that? Third of the year, half the year, how would you like tax-free, to like dump 40% of your salary? That's what that was. So it hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing compared to 10. So
right.
It hurt, but it's nothing compared to 10, as you said before, God.
Right.
So there's an acknowledgement that it hurts.
Yeah.
And I guess I don't know if this helps answer the question, just sort of pieces to throw out there. I heard one Christian man counselor say, when you're wrong, the very best thing to do is forgive. But that's hard. Second best thing is to punch him out and ask God's forgiveness about that. The third best thing is, which is way worse, but what most everybody does, is to pretend to forgive.
That's right.
And then you set yourself up for this miserable situation where you really haven't forgiven.
Yeah.
That's right.
And as a counselor, he's saying that we try to ignore the pain, the fear, the anger that we feel, we have put filters on our feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't get to really experience fully the love, joy, and peace.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
So there's this sense of okay, feel it. It is 100 denarius. It is 40% of a year's wage before tax. And it does hurt. But, I don't know. That's not a whole answer. It's not. It's just a piece of, maybe a piece of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when I was personally had a breakup, and I was feeling hurt, I said to God, you know, I wanted to ask God's forgiveness. You know, if I'm hurting, I must have done something wrong. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, you know, maybe it wasn't the wisest choice in a romance, but she was made in my image. What's so wrong about being attracted to someone made in his image? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's something really powerful there that, mm-hmm. that it will hurt.
Yeah, and the sense of loss is appropriate. It's
yeah.
Not, yeah, it's not, yeah. Yeah, that's helpful. Yeah.
Just on Lewis's thing, I think often that an issue of forgiveness like that is too complex to give an answer to you in a situation like this. Mm-hmm. Without yeah. hearing a lot more from you, mm-hmm. we can say it's complex, and then you can give up and say, "Oh, the grief, it's hopeless." Yeah. It's not at all hopeless. Mm-hmm. It's very important to get down to it, but with someone one-on-one, where you can get down to actually what happened, mm-hmm. what didn't happen, what are the options, mm-hmm. and it's wonderfully possible to move forward. Mm-hmm. But I think it's not something I like to try and deal with it in just a generic way. This mm-hmm. is what you do when you're hurt. Mm. Because there's so many ways of being hurt, so many ways of responding to it, and so on. So that's to pick that up with your tutor or whatever, and run with it. don't set a generic answer. But it strikes me just in general from your question, Anna, as well, as you started answering her on knowing what you're being forgiving for. Mm. It's amazing with the songs you've given. How unbelievably one-dimensional and simple the situation was.
Yeah.
Trying to
come
up with any Christian response to any of these things, you've got to have something you can never, ever get in under a three-minute song. You know, you can never squeeze it in.
Yeah.
Or try to, because it...
The complexity.
The complexity of it, trying to grapple with this before God, any of these things before God, is huge.
Yeah.
And this is all, it's all tied up and packaged and sent out.
Has to be a pop song.
That's right.
Yeah.
I was just thinking, there's a lecture on our computer there by Jim Wright Kirk who said the Dutch Slippery is called The Art of Letting Go.
Right.
Hmm. It might be a good thing to listen to.
He's not talking about this song.
He's not talking about this song. It was a lecture a long time ago.
That was solid 15 years ago.
It's a wonderful lecture, but I think, too, a piece of it, too, is also releasing some of those individuals and situations to God. I mean, the idea too that it's letting it go, but you're also letting it go to God. Those mm-hmm. people are still under God. Those actions are still seen by God. Those hurts are still under God. And acknowledging that, you know, his connection. That's an oversimplification, but it's a good lecture.
I think that's a lecture which there's a metaphor he uses. He's Dutch, and English is his second language. His English is excellent, but he's referring to... I think Dutch soldiers somewhere in Southeast Asia who would catch monkeys on the beach by putting, but he says donkeys by accident, and then eventually realizes it's monkeys. But anyway, by putting a piece of fruit in a bottle that has a narrow neck on it, and the monkey will reach in to grab the fruit, but it can't get its fist out of the hole. It can't get its hand out of the hole without letting go of the fruit. And that's how they catch the monkey. They just walk up and pick them up because the monkey won't let go of the food.
I've seen film of monkeys being caught that way.
Have you really?
And it was done with a gourd. You know, the native, you know, the gourd.
Yeah, yeah.
And the monkey is absolutely frightened, staring at his captor in
abject, unable to let go. Yeah.
Shaking the gourd.
Yeah.
Wondering why he's stuck,
right.
And there's no connection between the two.
It can't let go of the fruit,
mm-hmm. and the absolute panic.
It is a horribly powerful metaphor, isn't it?
But I've seen the film, and you think, how could anyone be so stupid?
But it's letting, I mean, in terms of, he's talking about all different kinds of things, I guess, in that lecture, but in the context of forgiveness. To not forgive is to hold on to a kind of a power over this other person, because you have them, you have some level of moral superiority over them, and you have the ability to, you know, at least in your own mind, make them squirm because they've wronged you. But it's not freedom. Actually, it feels like power, but
you're controlled.
You're actually controlled by it, and it's destroying you. And if you don't want to let go of it, then you're like the monkey with the hand of a drunk. Yeah. But you see the, I think you see the result of that. I mean, in actual people's lives, and people who are able to come to a point, even if it's a very, very long process of forgiving, there's a freedom there, and there's that's real. And people who keep a catalog of all the ways in which people have wronged them are miserable. And, so it's ultimately self-destructive thing to not forgive.
The irony of this seems to me is that what you're talking about is the thing we've got to let go is autonomy itself.
Yeah.
It's like the very thing that's celebrated is the very thing we've got to let go. You know, it's a, autonomy in all its forms.
Yeah.
It's touching every area.
Did you have something in the back, Molly, or that?
Yeah, I was kind of saying, like, I think that bearing in mind that our kind of format for making decisions in our culture right now is extremely reactive and extremely fast, and I think that we slightly lost the value of the idea of the passing of time for these things. And you see these songs, they are so reactive, it's like they're written like the next day, and I think we've really lost like something in terms of naming something and holding it and allowing time to pass over that before you take action. I think understanding that within the culture is really important, because I always think like, okay, something's happened, I must fix this now. And it's just, I think it's unhelpful at times.
Yeah. That's a helpful comment.
Well, one sort of miscellaneous thought, I was just thinking of that song. I'm not familiar with all the singers that you mentioned, but the one that has all the boxing metaphors, that there's just such ridiculous naivete in that, because in fact, you know, in fact, if she was in a boxing match with this guy, he'd beat her up. I mean, this is most
metaphorical roaring and punching.
I know, but it's so... It gives a picture that's just of a kind of strength. It's a naive strength.
You shouldn't watch the video if you think that's naive. The video, she's taming. She tames a tiger.
All right.
And somehow her inner spirit, which is a tiger, outgores the real tiger.
Oh, okay.
And her head, they're face to face with the tiger. The real tiger's growling, and she's growling at her. It's really stupid.
But I was thinking on the other thing.
It's a spoiler.
On forgiveness, the freedom in some, well, there'd be a lot of ways to say what the freedom is, but the freedom of real forgiveness and of naming sin as sin when someone has sinned against you would, in a way, could be described as the freedom to speak the truth in love. And there can be, thinking of some of these songs with people describing having more of a confidence, more of a strength, that there's a good kind of strength and confidence that can come. And that standing on the truth, not, you know, rah-rah me, but standing on the truth and having a freedom to be, which gives can give you a freedom from the control of that person who has controlled you. You know, it's controlled you through your life, but
it's a freedom that you don't have if self-esteem is the only option or the only goal, because you can only take on board things that affirm that.
It's a freedom that can come in standing in God's truth of what is actually true, what's happened, and I need to forgive, but I need to speak of this. This person needs to see what they've done. And there can be a confidence that isn't confidence so much in yourself, but in God's truth and in Him. I'm thinking in some cases, in these songs, it's almost like they're trying to convince themselves, like, that they are strong. Mm-hmm. And maybe this is a message that they wish, like, other people would tell them, or, like, they're really looking for application. Mm-hmm. Do you know what that particular injunction?
Yeah, that's interesting. Mm. So you say it louder to yourself that you're strong. You're right. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I don't know in terms of who actually wrote all these different songs. Like Mary Frances said, Taylor Swift, I guess, writes a lot of her own music. But a lot of these pop songs are just the public face of the song is just the performer and someone who's someone else is writing hits for them.
Well, they often go up for a bit between different artists.
Yeah.
If a song is really good. Like, right. When I was happy, it was actually, like, several different people wanted to perform it.
Okay, and he got it.
He got it.
Yeah.
And other which people is can
record,
perform
record,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, which is an academic, huge economic kind of bidding thing. I'm gonna wrap it up.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Thanks very much.
It's a very funny video. It's very clever. This relationship between this guy that's on and off and on. It's very much a celebratory comes around. The verses are all her arguing with the guy, and every time the chorus comes around, she's with her friends, like, jumping on the
bed. I'll have to check it out.
This fun song.
Recognizing the shallowness of the world and one genius. It's the first step. I mean, I realize, is the anger of a young man.
You know the song Mothers and Helpers too? It's a similar sort of critique of just kind of.
But I haven't even known the words.
Yeah, it's basically just about the housewife at home that gets stressed out with all of life's tensions, and she's depressed and everything, so she takes this little yellow pill. It's basically prozac.
Yeah.
It's like, basically helps her cope with life, but it's very cynical, it's very, but perceptive. I mean, she goes running to the shelter of her mother's.
little helper and it helps
a lot. That helps me with the situation, but it was just like the beginning. And I
just blew
off.
It's a God-given man, and God may reach at the way they choose to fulfill that need, but it's a God-given
man. But their response, their response, yeah. But the fact that they are responding is a sign of God.
And I share this with you
myself. I think there's more, there needs to be more Christians who write that kind of music, rather than offer or try to answer. It need to be just perceptively pointing out problems, basically. Right. I think, and that's what Christian Christians don't want to do, because they want to tie the Jesus bow on the end of it. But no one's going to take it seriously because of the rights.
I'd like to see some of the. Anyway, so thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks for coming.
You're welcome.
It was great to have you here. I appreciate your comments too. It's helpful clarifying a lot of stuff. Clarifying comments.
Yeah.
That's one of the things we enjoy about the discussion times. Well, that whenever we can't, whenever we don't have time to clarify, it's very obvious to clarify.
This is the second time I've been here. I'm impressed with what I'm hearing. So I like the.
I'm going to somehow.
It's good to try to flesh out ideas and not try and lock them in. And not to always just be theological intellectual. Because we're not afraid we're going to get. So I appreciate
it. Tom is a good idea.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks a lot, Tom. Appreciate it.
I am actually, I've never mentioned you, but I used to work instead of to go to school here, right? Yeah. And I
Ben, how did you play the song? I was wondering that, because it didn't look like you were pressing, or that no new screen came up on your laptop.
I had iTunes open, and I pressed a button on the top of the screen, which is for play and pause, so I could keep the PowerPoint presentation going, and I only realized this recently. So I opened up iTunes first, mm-hmm. and had my playlist right there, and then I opened up my PowerPoint presentation. You can control the tracks with this play. And you can advance the track or play or pause. So I just played and paused. I didn't realize that until very recently. It was very helpful.
Thanks, Ben.
Yeah,
that was
excellent. So thank you.
I really enjoyed it. Very good thing to think about.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I enjoy listening to it, actually. I like how you get the catchiness of all this music.
You have to stop and think about it.
Think critically.
Yeah, I was talking to someone about this in the beginning. You know, most people actually don't really listen to the words of pop music. Mm-hmm. And they can have like a song they really love. And years later, I realized what I was talking about.
Yeah.
You're
easily passive about it.
Nikki had the Beastie Boys blasting in her car once when she was a kid in high school, and her dad, she was driving her dad somewhere, and her dad was like,
Have you listened to what they're saying? She's like, you know, it's about like rape or something. It's like something horrible. And he's like, listen to it. I mean, so he didn't tell her, like, turn this thing off, it's horrible. He's like, listen to it. Listen, what are they? And by the end of the car ride, she was like, ah, and so I think, I don't know, my question is, how much of it, say little kids listening to this stuff, Katy Perry, you know, how much of it is just oblivious fun, and how much is actually getting imbibed somehow? Mm-hmm. Certainly if they're watching videos, a lot is getting imbibed. But a lot of this stuff, a lot of Katy Perry songs are just marketed to 8-year-olds. It's all about having sex. Mm-hmm. It's just like, what in the world is going on?
That's a really difficult parenting situation.
Yeah.
But I thought what you said about, you know, letting them listen to it, but then explaining to them,
how do you,
you know, what a different,
like, how kind of actually
message
they wrote
of the story, of the end of the story.
Well,
right.
What they're listening to, what that's like.
I think it's that's a conversation you can never have.
You start, if the first thing you do is to bring it.
And there's obviously some things you have. I mean,
or the tune brings about.
There's obviously some things you just have to prohibit, no matter what. But with something like this, hopefully, it remains to be seen, but hopefully it's better to watch it together and talk about it. Even if just your home becomes a place in which that can happen.
At least it keeps your kids a little bit in touch with our culture and the things that they will continue to deal with for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
And I think that part, there's actually a pretty good strong argument there.
Yeah.
Versus if you do the absolute, no, you will never listen to that ever. It's just an isolationist approach.
Yeah.
Which has its own power.
It's not giving them an ability to critique. Yeah.
I'm not sure it's really the best preparation long term.
No, not at all. I agree.
Yeah.
It's actually, fostering incapacity to actually think critically.
Or to not engage with other people
who
are going to have been raised on this music.
Right.
And to be able to understand where they're coming from
most
and relate with
them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You disagree with where our culture is going, unless you want to become Amish or something like that.
Right.
You have to be good to challenge it.
Yeah.
So it seems like 7-year-olds are certainly capable of starting on that, even if, like you say, there's certain lines you're not going to give your 7-year-old a certain level of confusing stuff. But
That's fine. I mean, and I'm sure Nikki and I are heavy-handed at times because we voice our opinions loudly about things in the garden. We find that, that's a lie, kids. You hear that? That's a lie. but I don't know. But our kids have kind of like taken on some of that themselves. I'm hoping not in a parrot-like way, but like, you know, there's moments. I'm trying to think
of
other songs in the soundtrack are just so funny. Oh yeah, this is song. Have you seen the movie?
Yeah.
The trolls are singing the Fixer Upper song. He's a bit of a Fixer Upper. There's this little bridge where one of the trolls says, cover your ears. one of the trolls says, like, I'm not saying you can change him because people don't really change, you know, which is just like this, like,
what?
Anyway, and I'm sure Ellie heard Nikki say something in one of them. So every time it comes to the song, people don't really change. Ellie's like, lie!
Wait a minute,
that's a lie! It's so funny.
Or the part where the
Love Is an Open Door song, where it's like a little puppy love song, where we just met each other, we're gonna get married.
Right.
And it's like, can I say something crazy? I'm like, will you marry me? Can I say something crazy? Yes! And the girl's supposed to say, stupid! Stupid! Never marry someone you just met! Well, as long as that's genuine, then I would say.
That was the look where you know you've done something right along the way.
or just been so obnoxious that they.
They
caught
your obnoxiousness.
Yeah, I don't know. Or they just kind of repeating what they heard. I'm not really sure. But, hopefully. I think they are. I think my kids, at least Ellie and Abby, are able to see the difference between the song and then the end of the movie.
Yeah.
That the song is incompatible at the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm. underestimate a 7-year-old.
I mean, I know. I'm sure.
Yeah.
They get a lot.
Yeah. That's good.
Have you seen the movie?
I'm gonna slip off to bed.
Right. So okay.
I have a. I can't deal with the Disney and Pixar movies.
Yeah.
I just can't deal with it.
In what way did you?
I don't know. I've seen a few, and I don't know. I don't know what it is. It's just some deep emotional aversion to it.
Okay. Is it the sort of like sickly sweet, the sort of saccharine, your dreams will come true kind of message, or?
No, I think it's just, I don't know. It seems sort of like having a message blared really unsubtly.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Well, that's true.
What you're saying,
so mm-hmm. like, yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah. That is true. I'm afraid. Well, I felt differently about different movies. Some Pixar movies are really rough. This one I felt, when I first saw it in the cinema, I didn't really know what I was getting into. My mother-in-law and I took my two daughters to, and I was kind of shell-shocked. I didn't know what to expect, but I think particularly the song was just like, what just happened? I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. It's just such a huge song, it's just so overpowering, and I don't know, I couldn't even begin the process of crying.
Well, I'm sure I'll see it someday, but I intend to be the last person in America to not.
Good. Well, I hope that goes well for you. What a worthy.
There's a few things I'm trying to be the last person on earth to experience, just to be that way.
Yeah. I felt that way about the movie Titanic back whenever that was.
I haven't seen that either.
I never saw that either. Every single person I saw.
It's not that great.
Yeah, it's not great.
Yeah, I heard it was awful.
But Kate Winslet's a babe.
She was. Is.
So.
Yeah.
It has some redeeming factors.
I did see Avatar by the same
time. I never saw that one. Was it good? Everyone raved about it.
It was visually really kind of cool, but mm-hmm.
It's a visual movie.
The story itself is totally recycled. Kind of like
most movies.
Yeah. It was basically like, people describe it as like Dances with Wolves. You ever see Dances with Wolves?
Mm-hmm.
Basically that, but in space. It's like, there's somebody who's kind of infiltrates this tribe, but then becomes part of the tribe and loves it.
It's definitely a 3D special effects movie.
It is pretty rockin' special effects.
We watched Casablanca last night.
Oh, did you really?
And I was wondering, do you know how to play As Time Goes By on the piano?
I can sort of fake it. I wouldn't do a good job at it. It's a great song.
Uh-oh.
You play very quietly. I don't know the whole song. How does it go? Can you sing it? Fundamental rules apply. I don't like the first couple bars. Something. Never mind. That was poor.
Oh, like most misquoted line ever is like played against Sam.
She
never says that.
She never says it, really?
No.
Does anyone say it?
No, she just says play it, Sam, for old time's sake.
Okay.
Play it against Sam is the Woody Allen film.
Right? Yeah, no,
so
but
that's
like,
probably where that.
No, but yeah, it's maybe he did that. Yeah,
did you ever see What's Up, Doc? That's a great movie.
Oh, no.
It's so funny. There's a scene when I play that song and they're in Farmer Streisand. She does like this hump to go there. She's like,
that's awesome.
All right, play
it again.
Thanks, Ben. See you all tomorrow.
See ya.
Night, Joe.
So many people gone last week.
Yeah.
Yeah, quite a few people have left.
It's shrinking.
Yeah, it comes and goes. Usually sort of ebbs and flows.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just wanted to apologize. You know, thing we talked about earlier. That's not going to happen.
Okay, great.
I was having a shitty 2 days. That was...
Good. I feel I'm not interested in focusing.
I mean, just the fact that you had, I feel bad about that. And I was already convicted about it earlier. I wanted to. So
good. You're good. We can chat about it on Monday.
Okay.
But I'm glad you're here, and I want to help you take advantage of it.